This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And we stream at the same time we broadcast at prairiepublic.org. And today we're starting with a very interesting fellow with an interesting story, I think, to tell about a film he's making. Dirk Wieringa is the filmmaker in question, and he is traveling a 1,500-mile route from the North Shore of Michigan to Shelby, Montana. And for what purpose, Dirk?
Well, it's really quite an interesting story because it's really about a 1,500-mile stretch, which is the center portion of US 2, and it's all about booms and busts. So, and basically, so it goes everywhere from the fur trapping to the iron ore, to the lumber, to the copper mining, and now to the oil here. Plus, there's, of course, agriculture with ranching and farming, which is its own boom and bust.
Well, you're from Grand Haven, Michigan. You're well south of Highway 2 in your state. So what drew you to that particular piece of road?
Well, a couple things. One is that I've traveled it very many times in my career, so I'm very well familiar with it. But more important probably is that I have a passion for rural America. And the challenge is that most people in urban areas, which is the vast majority of people, do not know what rural is, because they might live in, let's say, Washington, D.C., and they might go 20 miles into Maryland, find some rural areas and think it's rural. But those people are going to Johns Hopkins for their medical care.
And the film you're working on is Route to Elsewhere. What's the significance of the title?
Well, Elsewhere, well, Route 2 obviously is US 2.
Yes.
But Elsewhere is actually, I'm a big fan of the author of Blue Highways, William Least Heat Moon.
Yes.
And he very often uses the word elsewhere. And so it's kind of in honor of him.
That's a great book, and I have used it to inspire some car trips of my own. You know, the roads less traveled and for, you know, sort of self-discovery. It's an interesting book to read.
Absolutely.
Now, U.S. Highway 2 has an eastern route and a western route, and you're focused on the western piece, and not all of it, because it ends in Everett, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's correct.
Again, why this particular stretch?
Well, once you get past into the foothills of the mountains and start going through the mountains, it stops being the same kind of a road. It becomes more of a touristy, more of a large city of Spokane. You have the Everett, which is a part of basically of Seattle.
So yeah.
They just don't fit in with what Route 2 really is. When I
Googled it, Dirk, I discovered U.S. Highway 2 has an interesting Wikipedia page, mm-hmm. and it follows the old Theodore Roosevelt Highway that was intended back in, you know, about 100 years ago, mm-hmm. to connect Portland, Maine with Portland, Oregon.
yep, absolutely. And it cut through Canada on what became Canada 17. But when the U.S. highway system came up with the U.S. Designation, of course, the Canadians didn't want to be part of that.
Now, when did you start this project, and when do you think you'll be done with it?
Well, the starting of it really came conceptually about just over a year ago, when I started first initially making travel, and I decided that I was going to embed myself starting in September through this coming June, basically because it's very important to also cover weather. And so that ensures me all four seasons. Plus, the fact is I didn't want to travel the summertime because a lot of people along this route, that's the only time they make their money. And I don't want to be an interference.
Well, you're going to experience winter. I think we've got a nice taste of it coming.
Oh yeah, I spent 3 days in Grand Forks here during that last big storm about a month ago.
So you're back in Grand Forks. How often do you make the 1,500-mile drive?
I try to make it both directions. Obviously, start on one end, and then you have to go back to this where you started. So each time I make the route, it's usually 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay. And what do you do when you stop someplace? How do you decide where to stop and who to talk to?
Well, the initial work that I did way back a year ago identified a lot of key players. So I began to talk with those people, knowing that I would be coming and starting filming in September. And so I used them in order to find other people. And then as the social engagement step started coming, people are getting pretty active on that, on my Facebook page. And so I'll give you an example. Hopefully you won't mind me using his name. I wrote a little piece about Willow City because they have a school that closed there, and it just really devastated the town, especially in spirit. And so I wrote a little piece about it, and John Erdman, who owns a farm there, who's also a truck driver, he contacted me and he says, "I live there." I said, "Can I come and interview you?" He said, "Fine." So, and he's been just a marvelous person to be talking to because he's got a good sense of both why two jobs are important and really why, and he understands the trucking part of it, and he understands family farming, and he really wished that he could just stay doing family farming. But he said, once it gets into your life, you never want to lose it.
Well, Route 2 is a very important route for trucks through North Dakota. I know that very well. And Dirk, you have been on this route more than once now, and you established some relationships, if you will, with people. So how do you intend to tell the story?
Well, first of all, I've still got 5 more months of taping, so I'm halfway through. But each time that I meet other people, they lead me to other people. A lot of times I start with economic development because that's pretty prevalent. A lot of times I'll use chambers of commerce. But they get me kind of to the next level of person. And then once I'm with that level, I really want to stay with that particular story. So the main stories, an example would be, I've got Blue Weber here in downtown Grand Forks. He's one of the people that's in it. John Erdman, like I mentioned. Leela Peterson, who's an author of the book Selma, which is all about homesteading. I have Jessie Veeder, who's a rancher, singer-songwriter.
We know her, yeah.
Yep, she's wonderful, incredible writer. And singer, and her father, who used to be head of economic development there, Gene.
Yes.
And also Merrick and Julia Petrovic over at Farmtastic Food down in Anamoose. So I try to have 4 to 6 stories per state that become kind of the method by which to tell the story.
You're talking about boom and bust towns, and Highway 2 was created before the interstate highway system, which bypassed a lot of towns, for example, a lot of towns on Highway 2. And so talk a bit about how the times and have affected people in a boom and bust way. We all know about the oil patch in North Dakota, but there are towns in the middle of Highway 2 in North Dakota that next to each other, one's successful, the other is less successful.
And you know, so much of that was really James J. Hill in the planning of the Great Northern, because, you know, US 2 really follows that route.
And US 10 follows the other one. The other
Oh, I know, and which he bought later on. Yeah. So it's a wonderful story because of the fact that each of those boom and busts, and agriculture is a very big part of the story, of course, in North Dakota. And part of what really drives the loss of population in those towns is actually the efficiency of modern day ranching and farming, is that you need a larger ranch or farm, and you need fewer people there. Well, if you have a town that used to have, let's say, 500 people, and it had a hardware store and a grocery store and a gas station and so forth, all of a sudden now you have a fraction of that population that's ever coming into that town. So it starts to close businesses, and it just kind of builds on itself.
Dirk Wieringa is a filmmaker. He's working on a documentary, Route 2 Elsewhere. He's traveling on U.S. Highway 2 from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan to Shelby, Montana. How has this project informed you about the challenges, though, some towns and people face? Because, again, you've got small town A doing well, you know, 10, 15 miles down the road, small town B, failing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there can be a number of reasons for that. A lot of times it can come right down to the leadership within a community where, you oftentimes hear a city person, somebody in a city talking about when the council flipped. And by that, what they mean is that they kind of went from the old guard to a newer guard. And the old guard, really, they were all about the backbreaking type work. You know, they moved dirt, they built things. That's the type of, and so they see that as being jobs. But now the newer people, they see it more like, how can I live where I want to live? So in other words, how can I stay in North Dakota, which is a big part of this, and also still have a successful career? Well, you can if you have business grade internet. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that people think that they may have it because they can get a Netflix film. but the reality is that business grade internet is all about how much you can push and create and push out onto the internet. And most people don't have that. In fact, but there are some really wonderful examples out there of towns that are growing quickly. One's in Minnesota, not too far from here, is Bemidji. And they have the high-speed internet available to everybody there because they have a nonprofit that was able to really underwrite a lot of the funding of it.
Yeah, they also have a university and a community college system up there, mm-hmm. too. So young people are there, and I think mm-hmm. that's part of the issue that you may have been confronting as you go along Highway 2. Some of these towns don't have any young people in them.
That's exactly right. I call it the missing generation, which are people 24 to 49. They're the people that typically are going to have families, and if they're not around, you're losing population. And a lot of times, it really comes down to looking up the people who left that did not want to leave, because most people don't want to leave. They leave because they have to leave. And if the same type of an opportunity can be had around in the town that they want to come back to, that's possible. And again, if they're able to work off-site and live in an area where they like, and of course we know the off-site work is becoming a huge part of our economy.
Dirk Wiering has a Facebook presence, as he mentioned, and his last name, and he told me it's Dutch, is spelled W-I-E-R-E-N-G-A. And Dirk, I saw a posting you had from February 9th. I just want to share it with our listeners. If America is going to become a greater country, we need to stop judging and start listening.
Yes, that's very important. And at the time, I was just leaving Watford City, and I was actually looking at a guy unloading his trailer. He was moving there from Texas. And what people don't realize is in Watford City, as an example, is a very diverse economy. It has people from all 50 states, 20-some foreign countries, and they have actively been diversifying their economy. So even though they have income from the oil, they're using that in order to build a much bigger economy because they don't want to go through the same kind of boom and bust that other towns have gone through.
And they've gone through it because there was a boom in the 50s, there was a boom in the 80s, and mm-hmm. and now there's a boom in the 21st century.
Yep.
And I think they've perhaps learned a couple of lessons.
I think the whole state's learning good lessons about this.
Well, Watford City was an interesting example because when the boom hit it, of course, all of these oil workers were coming into town, and some of them, frankly, didn't last long. They moved mm-hmm. back because the weather can be intimidating, and the jobs became, you know, the extraction business became more efficient, and they didn't need as many people. Mm-hmm. But that influx created a need for restaurants and laundromats and mm-hmm. other services that towns that are growing require. And so now those services remain, I take it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the growth that they're seeing, because an awful lot of the oil jobs are temporary jobs. They come in, they do their job, they're not going to buy and build or buy a house. And so it's the people that are investing in the community, and those are local people.
How do you cover the expenses for the time and travel to make this documentary?
Well, so far, my partner, Vern Jones, and his wife, Irene, and myself, we're partners in Principia Media. And we're just kind of self-funding it at this point, waiting to see what happens. What we would love to get it on PBS. PBS, so really wants to see something fully developed first, and so that's a part of why we're doing it the way we're doing it. But we're very committed to this project. It's going to go out somewhere, someplace, and in a broadcast manner.
Well, I noted on your IMDb page, that's the internet directory for movies and filmmakers and people like you, that you started a marketing communications agency back in the 1980s, and mm-hmm. you made your first real documentary film was a full-length episodic documentary for television, D.B. Cooper, The Real Story. That was back mm-hmm. in 2018.
Yep.
So if PBS doesn't bite, is this a reality TV project?
I don't know if it's a reality TV. I would say that it would be more of a standard story based type of film, but we're really kind of waiting because, as I said, I've got five more months of being out here, and so you really don't know. I can tell you, I have a lot of footage,
and you. All by yourself. You're the filmmaker, you're the editor, and you're asking the questions. So that's a pretty intimate interview style and probably gets some real candor out of people.
Well, people really don't really want to talk to people. I've had a lot of people that I've interviewed that had also been interviewed or known of people that were interviewed by major media from, you know, one of the coasts. And those people would have a tendency to bomb in and bomb out and do a quick interview in a coffee house and they're on their way. And so, and then when they see the story later on, it doesn't have anything to do with the truth that they felt. So people are very skeptical of that. So it's very important for me to get into their lives a lot more and to learn from them. I am learning so much. I learn incredible amount every day, but it's from the people that I talk with.
So your style would be to sit down and probably talk for quite a while. You probably want to at least do some editing on paper.
Well, actually, we're not even going to start the post-production until probably early July, and that'll probably take 6 months or more.
Well, I'm just thinking, Al said this about a half an hour into our chat. because you know, 5 months from now, you're going to have hundreds of hours of video?
Pretty much, yeah. Well, it gives us a lot of choices.
Yes. Yeah, you might go blind doing it.
Well, in fact, I was talking to Chuck Wilder, who he owns Books on Broadway in Williston, and he was saying, he said, you're the new Charles Kuralt.
And I said, on the road with Charles Kuralt. Yes.
Yeah. And I said, well, actually, there's so much stuff that it could be episodic.
Well, Charles Kuralt actually came through Fargo a long, long time ago when he was doing the On the Road pieces, and he was a very approachable guy, and I think that mm-hmm. probably helps if you want to talk to people about real life and their real struggles.
Well, people are really looking for authenticity right now, and I don't think they're getting it so much from political figures. And as a result, I think as a country, we've kind of gotten our differences are defining us more than what we share in values. And actually, what I'm learning from this story is really how shared those values are. We are an incredible country. We just need to realize that.
Well, you mentioned Blue Weber. He's the executive director of the Downtown Development Association in Grand Forks, and you were talking to the Greater Grand Forks Young Professional Association mm-hmm. when you were interviewed for the Forum News Service
yes.
back in the middle of December.
Wonderful organization.
So the idea that I'm getting here is that you might come up with some, you know, proposals for towns that might help them boost themselves.
I could see that happening. And of course, we're also a book publisher, so we are always looking for books. And there's a lot of people that are into writing historical books. So we've kind of talked to some people about that too. But if you really believe in something and if you throw yourself into it, eventually something good comes from it, no matter what. And if this doesn't turn into what I envisioned it to be, it's going to turn into something that is the proper vision.
Dirk Wieringa is a filmmaker. His work in progress is Route to Elsewhere. He joined us from our microphone in Grand Forks. Good fortune to you, Dirk.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure being here.
Coming up on Main Street, a commentary from Mark Trahant.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Claude Monet loved his gardens at Giverny.
So here is a garden of great beauty that nourished him, inspired him.
A fixer-upper off the coast of Brittany can be a lot more than just a second home.
This island allowed us to sort of construct a full life around the wildness that's inside of us.
And Americans find romance in Italy.
The first time we went out, we had a dictionary between us on the table.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant is the editor of the online news service Indian Country Today. He also writes commentaries about issues and current events. Today, Mark's commentary is about the budget proposal released Monday by President Donald Trump.
Every winter, the White House releases a budget for the federal government. The document outlines the president's priorities in the year ahead. Then Congress pretty much ignores that document and enacts a budget of its own. And that is true, no matter which party runs the White House. But even if the budget does not become law, it does open a window into the thinking of a presidential administration. This budget follows a familiar pattern. It will spend $4.8 trillion, and it carries a promise to balance the budget within 15 years. But to get there, it carries deep spending cuts to domestic programs, an idea that Congress has rejected. It would also spend more money on the military and leave Social Security and Medicare benefits the same. It is an election year document. Republicans will like the increase in military spending, and Democrats are unhappy with the proposed spending cuts. Last year, it was pretty much the same proposal. Then Congress said no, and finally a deal was reached between the White House and House Democrats. This plan erases that deal and imposes an immediate 5% cut to all non-defense spending. Agencies that would be hit hard include a 27% increase to the Environmental Protection Agency, fewer dollars for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and 9% cut to the Department of Health and Human Services, including the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control and Protection, the agencies charged with figuring out how to treat the coronavirus. A special concern to Indian Country. The proposal to take $700 billion from Medicaid over the next decade. One way the Trump administration hopes to accomplish that goal is by creating waivers so states can swap program flexibility for less funding. The idea, then, is that states could design programs that would better serve citizens. That's the theory, anyway. In recent years, the Indian Health Service has been dramatically reshaped by Medicaid spending. It now accounts for funding for about one out of every four patients. And that's a conservative figure. The number is probably higher. In the State of Indian Nation speech Monday, National Congress of American Indians President Fawn Sharp called the federal budget incompetent. Nothing in the document released by the White House will change that perception. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark Trahant and Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, horticulturist and wine enthusiast Ron Smith offers some rose and vino ideas for Valentine's Day. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. A quick but powerful shot of Arctic weather. That's how the National Weather Service is characterizing the snow and blowing snow coming to parts of North Dakota late tonight into tomorrow. National Weather Service Spokesman Ken Samosko in Bismarck says the Arctic front will come down from the north late tonight, bringing snow and wind. He says part of the state will get 1 to 3 inches of snow, and he says the winds will kick up behind the snow to 25 to 35 miles an hour.
So that's going to lead to blowing and drifting snow across the region. So that's mainly what the winter weather advisory is hinting at, is the blowing and drifting snow with the winds coming in behind the front. And that's going to reduce the visibility to below 1 mile. Generally, we'll see about a half mile. But you get into the James River Valley, there could be some locations that will be near blizzard conditions, which would be less than 1/4 mile at times. But that would be mainly for the open country.
So Samosko says once the front moves through, the next thing to contend with is very cold air.
It won't be long-lasting, but it'll be with us Wednesday night through Thursday. We're looking at wind chill values mainly along and east of the Missouri River between 25 and 40 below zero by Thursday morning. So something to keep in mind, especially as the kids get off to school, and remember your pets outside as well.
But Samosko says expect temperatures to moderate by the weekend. North Dakota's tax commissioner says so far state income tax filings are a little ahead of last year. Ryan Rauschenberger says to date, around 66,000 returns have been filed, compared with 57,000 last year at this time. Rauschenberger says 98% of those have been e-filed, and he says the refunds are running about the same as last year, averaging about $174 per return. Rauschenberger says his department is continuing with its fraud prevention efforts, so refunds may be delayed a day or so. He says those efforts have paid off.
Over the last 5 years, we've stopped about 1,500 cases totaling about $2 million in fraudulent refunds from going out the door.
Rauschenberger says he also expects a little bit of an uptick in the overall number of filers this year.
I would say this year around somewhere between 480,000 and 485,000. Last year, we had about 478,000.
And Rauschenberger says as the deadline approaches and the returns get more complicated, he does expect the e-filing numbers to drop a bit. And members of the Fargo City Commission have voted to move ahead with further planning for a proposed performing arts center downtown. City Administrator Mike Redlinger was directed to draft a plan to gauge support for the project, which is dependent on cost sharing from the private sector. The estimated price tag on the project could be as much as $75 million, up from an estimated $53 million based on a 2015 study. Such a study could take 4 to 6 months to complete and cost about $100,000. For Prairie Public, I'm Todd McDonald.
Giving Hearts Day, a 24-hour fundraising event in North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota, is happening on Thursday, February 13th. We hope you'll consider giving to Prairie Public. You can schedule your Giving Hearts Day gift to Prairie Public today by going to prairiepublic.org/ghd.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and Valentine's Day is just a few days away. It's Friday, February 14th, and Ron Smith joins us. He's a retired NDSU Extension horticulturist and a wine lover, so we're going to talk about flowers and wine and maybe even what gardeners should be thinking about in February.
Okay.
Okay.
It's good to think about it anyway.
So let's start about one of these big holidays for florists that's coming up.
Well, it's Valentine's Day, and Valentine's Day signifies to probably 95% of the people out there that I want to give my sweetheart a red rose.
Yeah.
And or red roses. And there's a little bit of a point that I want to make to people that want to give them either a dozen, your sweetheart, a dozen roses, red roses, which are very beautiful and probably would be interpreted as being very, very, very generous and also very expensive, or just a single rose. So if you give a single rose to the one that you love and have loved for a long time, that signifies that there's no other sweetheart in your life. This is the only one.
Well, thank you for that.
Yes, yes.
Already.
Yes.
You've really made Valentine's Day.
Whether there's
so
any
much
validity
more
to that, I don't know.
Well, that's
but
less,
if you give her a
expensive
dozen roses,
yeah,
you're one of the many that I love.
Oh,
so,
boy.
So that's I play it safe and always give one rose.
I'm using that one.
Okay.
I'm using it, definitely.
Okay. But it's the favorite flower of Venus, the mythological Roman goddess associated with love and passion and everything else. And so the red rose is indisputably the best rose to give to their sweetheart, your sweethearts. Whether you want to give her a dozen red roses, most people don't know the analogy that I just gave you there, or one rose or two or three roses.
But how about long stem versus regular stem?
I don't think it makes any difference. Yeah. Long stem sounds more...
has more thorns on it.
Well, they dethorn them.
Oh, okay.
They have, thank you. The florists have a way of dethorning them. Now, there's other rose colors that you can go ahead and give, depending on your relationship with the people that you want to give roses to. You might want to give them to a secretary or a coworker or something like that. Be careful. Don't make it a red rose because it's liable to be misinterpreted. So you can give roses that would be, say, a white rose. Well, that's true love, purity, and reverence. You can give a yellow rose, which is friendship, celebration, and joy.
Or somebody from Texas.
Yeah. Yellow rose, very good. Excellent. Or you can do like I did with my sister when she turned 40 many, many, many years ago. I sent her a black dead rose. What that means, it's adios, it's over. Our relationship is finished. You won't hear any more from me.
I bet you did hear some more from her, though.
Yes, I hear from her just about every day. And so, so a bouquet of red and white roses indicates a bonding and harmony between the two of us. And so that's, you want to make it a safe thing. You want to give a lot of roses. Don't give a lot of red roses, but give a mixture of red and white roses, and it'll indicate that we're very harmonious after 40, 50 years of our marriage and so on and so on.
So would a pink rose be wishy-washy then?
Well, a pink rose, no, it's friendship, sweetheart, and admiration. Though this might be something if you're trying to get her attention. Somebody you admire, and she's kind of sweet on you. You're very sweet on her. And so you want to go ahead and give her a lot of... in a lot of admiration. You have wonderful, beautiful hair today. You look great in that outfit today, that type of thing.
So. Well, I don't want to, get you in any trouble here, but is Betsy getting one red rose?
Yes, she's going to get one red rose because there's no other woman in my life, anywhere near in my life, that would be considered a sweetheart.
Well, I have the same set of circumstances. So, again, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Now, how long does a rose last?
Well, roses last a pretty good length of time. And the trick to this is to buy a tightly cupped red rose. In other words, it should be just starting to break as far as opening goes. And the florist will put a little bit of a life extender into the vase that you get your rose in. I assume that you would give it to her in a vase with a ribbon and, a little card and everything else. That material lasts a long time. You can buy some extra material from the florist at that time, or you can do what a lot of people swear up and down that it will work, is aspirin, just straight, unbuffered aspirin, the cheapest aspirin you can find. Unbuffered aspirin, break it up and put it in there, and the salicylic acid that is made up of aspirin will keep bacteria from forming in the cut end. And the other thing to do is to make a fresh cut on that long stem rose.
Kind of a diagonal one?
I'm sorry? A diagonal one, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Make a cut no matter what kind of a packet the florist gives you to extend the life of that rose. So that's the way to do it.
And now, where do all these roses come from?
Oh, my gosh. They come from Central America, Mexico, some greenhouses here in the United States, but they could be very expensive. And so it depends on who the wholesaler is, what kind of shipments they have. You know very well that we can get strawberries, blueberries, raspberries, blackberries, kiwis 12 months out of the year when they aren't available here 12 months out of the year, and they're very reasonable. So they come from all parts of the world, and so do our flowers. But most of them will come from Central America, Mexico, any other Caribbean island that might be going ahead and growing them, but primarily from Central America, Mexico, and possibly some big greenhouse growers that want to go ahead and grow some roses locally here. But they've got that extra expense as far as heating watering goes, whereas in the Central American parts of the world and Mexico, they don't have that kind of a problem to face.
You know, in my lifetime, the business of the florist has been gone from the guy, whatever you can grow in the greenhouse.
Yes, yeah,
to
absolutely. Yeah.
Any place in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Greenhouses used to be the big thing, the 800-pound gorillas to do that kind of thing. And then transportation became more efficient. Volume became better. Costs went down. People, you know, in the Central American and the Mexican parts of the country, of the world, can go ahead and produce those things a lot cheaper than greenhouses can. So the greenhouses are gradually folded out of business because of the costs involved. They're outrageous costs. People that think they want to have a greenhouse in their backyard, check the costs, not only just
remember where you live.
Yes, and remember where you live. Absolutely.
It's cold out there.
Yes, absolutely.
You're also an enophile. People who know Ron Smith knows that he used to write a column about wine and is still a lover of that beverage. So let's talk about wine in Valentine's
Day. Okay, wines are very popular. The best wine to get involved with your sweetheart, whether you're going out for dinner, and I'm taking my wife out for dinner, we'll probably get a sparkling wine. And you can get a pink sparkling wine, pink champagne if you want to.
Or Prosecco or something like
Prosecco,
that.
Prosecco, yes. You don't have to have champagne if you don't want to bust the budget, which you would doing if you got champagne. But a pink sparkling wine would be a very, very good thing. A good mellow red wine, and in spite of the unpopularity that it suffered from the result of the movie Sideways, Merlot is a very good wine. It's actually one of the best wines in the world because it blends so well. And it's for people that think they don't like red wine. If you get a good Merlot, it's very soothing to your tongue, your taste buds, and it has a nice, soft, lingering aftertaste. So it's not going to be one of these dominant wines like, wow, I had wine for dinner, but I don't remember what I had for dinner, you know, that type of thing. So the red wine is good. White wines, maybe it would be appropriate if you're going to be going out for lunch and not for dinner that night.
How about a rosé?
A rosé would be perfect. Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Well, I'm into red wine, so is the person I would be, you know, celebrating on Valentine's Day. Mm-hmm. And Cabernet.
Cabernet Sauvignon is very good. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Now, is that just the name of the grape? What is Cabernet?
Yeah, no, those are the grape names.
Okay.
Yeah. And the nice thing about American wines is most of the time they will have the name of the grape right there on it. In some places, like in Italy, they'll have a name on there, and you have to search the label to figure out, oh, well, that's a Cabernet or a Chianti, what we call Chianti, where it's a Sangiovese wine is the Chianti wine, but we all know what is Chianti in that little bulbous bottle and everything else.
And
it's good. It's great stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So if you have a little bit of Italian blood in you, or you think you have some, or you want to be a romantic like an Italian, why, go ahead and have Chianti.
So
a bulbous bottle.
The Cabernet grape isn't just grown in France and California or wherever.
No. It's grown all the way down into New Zealand, in California. As the climate gradually gets warmer, it's being moved further and further north into Oregon and Washington. Some of the valleys up there have it.
So when you look at a wine label, and, you know, I look at it and, gee, it's a pretty label and the price point's right and that, but I don't know anything about what's in it except it says it's Cabernet.
Mm-hmm.
What do you look for on a label?
Okay. Number one, I don't pretend I know everything because I don't. Number two, I look at the right side of the menu and see what the price ranges are.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the top price and then there's the bottom price. Somewhere in between, like the second or third price down from the top, will give you a good, very good wine. And I would certainly ask the server. He or she might be a sommelier, but keeping it quiet. And so they are amazing people because they have the kind of minds that can sit down and study all this stuff, keep it in their minds forever, take a taste of wine, and come back with a verbiage that you, even you, a loquacious man like yourself, would say, my gosh, where did you come up with all these wonderful adjectives to describe this wine? You know, because you'd say, well, it's good, or it's pretty interesting. That's what you and I would probably say. That's cool. Okay. They can come up with it. Get licorice, tobacco,
chocolate,
pepper, chocolate, rosemary, chives, you know, all these things. I don't get any of that, but
yeah.
I mean, it seems to be they have that taste, and they have to pass the test on that. So it's not something you just write out a check and say, now I'm a sommelier.
So, because these people really have to have a highly trained palate.
And they have to have a good memory to remember all these things. Excellent memory.
So Is it the same importance, I mean, the winery and the vintage? What's the significance of the year?
The vintage indicates that was the year that the grapes were harvested. So if you have a 1996 vintage Merlot, that was the year that it was harvested, okay, and it was made into wine.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have that now, that's a well-aged wine. Whether it'll still be good or not depends on how well it's been handled and stored and everything else, and also the winery that it came from. So some people will tune in to a wine label based on the winery itself. And if you are in love with a particular winery in California or in France or Italy or Spain or wherever, you're going to follow along on those vintages and see that if this vintage is as good as the vintages that you fell in love with, say, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago.
But wouldn't the winery, the person who's putting together that bottle, again, have that sommelier's sort of sense and would give you the same flavor year after year?
They work like mad to do that. They do everything they can to go ahead and come up with a blend that'll be just exactly right. Keep in mind that in some areas, in order for it to be called Merlot, it has to have 80% Merlot in there.
But it might be a blend. Huh?
And so it would be a blend, but it's mostly Merlot, so they can call it Merlot. And some wineries I know in Washington, they want it 90%. And so the 10% gives you a narrower playing field to go ahead and do that. So once they find that something is popular, they're going to do everything within their technological power to try to correct any misgivings that Mother Nature might have given to the wine and go ahead and produce something that the buyer will say, yeah, this is as good as the one I enjoyed back in 2006 and 2007 and 2008, 9, 10, 20, 20, whatever, you know.
So to, you know, somebody who is as uninformed as I am, the winery sounds to be more important than the year of the wine.
Hmm. Absolutely. Getting to know your winery and the wineries today that are on the competitive market are very competitive. They almost literally have their fingers on your pulse to find out what it is you're trending to like, what it is that sells hot, you know. And they also know very well that you're only going to have snob appeal to people that want to only buy wines that cost $75 or more per bottle. I'll never be that way. Never, you know, unless somebody gives me $75 and tells me to go ahead and buy it, and they'll pay for it. Now, yeah, if you're crazy enough to do that, I'll take their $75 and do it. Most of the wine that is consumed is under $20 in cost.
All right. Well,
and enjoyed.
You know, occasionally we have these oddball stories about a bottle of wine that's been discovered or has been kept in a cellar for, you know, a couple hundred years or something like that.
Yeah.
Is that vinegar or is that wine?
Well, it might be. Eat one or the other.
But people pay these exorbitant prices for
this. They, you know, you and I don't, we are not millionaires or billionaires, so we can't throw away $150,000 on this bottle of wine that some character claims he found in the cellars of ancient Rome that it's going for a bid. And so there's nutcases out there, I'm sorry to be using that because I'm sure we don't have any in our listening audience, out there that have all kinds of money that say, I want that bottle of wine. And the biggest fraud there was the one that they found that Thomas Jefferson supposedly put his initials on. And the guy, I won't mention his name, but had all kinds of money, and he spent over $200,000 for that bottle of wine. And when they did take a sample from it, and they can go ahead and take a hypodermic needle sample from it, it didn't sort out that way, and then they had examined the label, and there was no, Thomas Jefferson never signed his name on a label, and so they figured that they came up with the conclusion was that it was signed in Thomas Jefferson's signature style, but with a dental instrument that could go ahead and scratch it into the label.
So fraud in wine.
Oh, my God. It's a big deal. If you have, anybody out there wants to be a wine fraud detective, I should say, there's a great opportunity out there because there's going to be an awful lot of fraudulent wines being sold that are supposed to be top-notch French, German, Italian, Spanish, American wines. And so,
well, I'm going to change the subject a little bit here, but you and Betsy have been married a long time, right?
43 years, going on 44.
Okay, so I asked you, she probably knows what you're going to give her, so I'm not giving anything away here. You're going to give her that one red rose.
Mm-hmm.
What wine are you going to?
Well, I have a wine cellar.
Yes.
Skip knows that. He's seen my wine cellar for whatever it's
That's
worth.
Skip Wood, our producer.
Yeah. But I'll look over at the wine cellar and see what I consider would be the best. We're going to go out to dinner. Mm-hmm. We're going to go to Luna for dinner.
Good place.
And they have excellent selections of wine because the owner is also the manager of
the liquor store next door.
Next door, yes, absolutely. And so we will probably sit down and talk to her about what would be the good wines to whatever we're going to be ordering. And I don't know what we're going to be ordering, but whatever our temptations succumb to at that particular point. So, yes, we will have a wine. And if it's a really good wine, if you can afford it, I would suggest buying the whole bottle because you don't have to worry about it being opened a week ago or 4 days ago, and you're maybe getting a little bit of stale wine. So if you can buy the whole bottle, just make sure that you can go ahead and take it out. They'll recork it for you and bag it and take it out. And
well, let me
it.
Throw you something from left field. What about buying the whole box?
Well,
you know, the box wines, the 3
Oh, the box,
box
wines. I don't want to talk about that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Because that's how I started out a long time ago.
All right. But they say they last a long time because they're in a bag that
hermetically
collapses.
Sealed, literally.
Yeah.
Literally.
Okay. Well, let's move to the last topic that I mentioned mm-hmm. we talk about, and that's it is February. It's cold out. We're mm-hmm. expecting a real cold day tomorrow, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
And yet people want to think about gardening, and I know mm-hmm. your Betsy likes to think about gardening.
Yes, she does. So far, she has looked at and drooled over and made notes on the various catalogs that have come into our mail about what she wants to go ahead and do and how she's going to plant it and everything else. But she has resisted making the purchase because if you get it in hand, it's like saying, well, here's a pecan pie for you to enjoy this Valentine's Day. And here it is, what, Tuesday?
Uh-huh.
Well, do you think that pecan pie is going to sit around till Tuesday?
No.
No. You're going to take a sample. Gosh, that's awfully good. But we'll save a piece for Valentine's Day, but you'll eat 3/4 of it between now and Valentine's Day, something like that. So it's one of those things you're going to be tempted to plant it, and once you get going, the growth continues. The grow lights, which you should get, is a full-spectrum light, and they do have spotlights now that will go ahead and beam onto a plant that you want to go ahead and have specifically get the full spectrum of light equivalent, sunlight
equivalent.
But is
it too early to be planting for spring?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt, it is way too early. Most people will start their plants inside for their vegetables, their tomatoes, cabbage, cauliflower, not lettuce or string beans or anything like that. But basically, the tomato plant is the number one plant. Tomatoes and peppers are the big plants that they go ahead and get started. So you're too early. Wait until April's Fool's Day, at least, to get them ordered, get them in hand by April 1st, April Fool's Day, and then possibly go ahead and start your planting because you want to give yourself about 6 weeks before planting out. 6 weeks from April 1st is put you into about the middle of May. That might be the right time to go ahead and transplant them because you don't want them as long as from your elbow to your fingertips. They're too big then. They go through transplant shock too much.
And Betsy has planted too early before, I take it.
Depending on if she's listening to this, she has. And if you see me next time with a black eye.
Oh, no. She's getting flowers.
Yeah, she
flower.
Is. Oh, okay,
she's
yeah.
getting a good wine.
Yeah, yes.
And she has enjoyed the catalogs.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. She loves them.
Right.
So, thanks.
It's always a pleasure to have Ron Smith in with us to talk on Main Street about,
whatever.
Flowers, wine, gardening.
And thanks. Wives.
That's right. Thanks, Ron.
You're welcome.
Dakota Datebook is next.
The Greater Grand Forks Community Theater presents the state premiere of Lovesick, an absurdist little comedy by John Cariani, January 30th through February 15th at the Fire Hall Theater. Reserve tickets by calling 701-777-4090.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 11th. Sacagawea gave birth to Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau on this date in 1805. Lewis and Clark were wintering at Fort Mandan and had hired Toussaint Charbonneau and his pregnant wife, Sacagawea, as interpreters for the next leg of their Corps of Discovery expedition. Meriwether Lewis wrote about the birth, saying, "One of the wives of Charbonneau was delivered of a fine boy." Little Jean-Baptiste was less than 2 months old when the expedition headed west in April. William Clark took a special shine to the healthy and active baby and gave him a nickname, calling him Pomp or Pompey. In the spring of 1806, during their return journey, the corps was bogged down by deep snow in the Bitterroot Mountains. Pompey contracted a high fever. He may have been teething, but his swollen neck and throat indicates that he probably had mumps or tonsillitis. The expedition leaders applied poultices to the little boy's neck made of wild onions, pine rosin, beeswax, and bear oil. Despite this medicinal aid, it was 2.5 weeks before Pomp recovered. Several months later, Clark led a small group, including the Charbonneau family, on a side trip to explore the Yellowstone River. They came upon an unusual sandstone formation on the river's south shore that Captain Clark named Pompey's Tower, now called Pompey's Pillar. He also named a nearby stream, Baptiste Creek, for the Corps' favorite baby. When the expedition arrived back at the Hidatsa Mandan villages the following month, Captain Clark had a hard time saying goodbye. He offered to take Pomp and raise him as his own son, but Sacagawea was still nursing her little Baptiste. 3 years later, Charbonneau, Sacagawea, and little Pomp traveled to see Clark in St. Louis. Toussaint and the rest of the expedition's enlisted men were each given 320 acres of land, and while Sacagawea received nothing, Toussaint was paid $533.33 for his interpreter services. Charbonneau quickly tired of farming, however, and after a few years sold his land to Clark for $100. He and Sacagawea boarded a barge bound for the upper Missouri River country, and Clark finally got his wish. 6-year-old Pomp remained with him to begin his formal education. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We are on a quarantined ship, the Diamond Princess.
On a cruise ship docked off Japan, coronavirus cases are rising.
When you have people in such close quarters like that, it's extremely hard to control that outbreak.
How is the cruise industry responding to a crisis? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, the ever-rising cost of prescription drugs is one of the biggest concerns for the AARP. And on our show tomorrow, we'll visit with North Dakota State Director Josh Askvig and special guest Megan O'Reilly. She's from AARP's national office in Washington, D.C. O'Reilly is the vice president of the Federal Health and Family Group in the AARP's Government Affairs Department. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.